You may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Brian Holtis. I represent Raymond Grauer and RDA Group, the appellants, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
You've got a clock there. Just keep track of your time.
Thank you. Unlike the other cases, we raised several issues on appeal, and I'd like to start first with the standing issue.
Excuse me? The standing issue?
Right at the beginning of the trial.
You mean capacity to sue?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. At the beginning of the trial, we stood up and said, Your Honor, the plaintiff, Stepanow Inc., is a Maryland corporation. Its charter has been forfeited. They cannot sue or be sued. It can't even do an appeal.
And the district court said?
The district court said, this is the first day of trial. We will take evidence as to the whole trial, and I'll reserve the issue.
And ultimately, the district court said?
Ultimately, the district court denied the motion.
Because?
Because
it was untimely.
It was untimely.
Wasn't it?
It was. The motion itself, the notice to the other side was not untimely. At the very beginning of the case, before my client was even a party, when the complaint was filed, there was a motion to dismiss, claiming that the plaintiff was in default. The plaintiff cured its default, got back in good standing, and the case proceeded. That was in 98. In 1999, we took the deposition of the plaintiff's president and said, according to the state records, your corporation is in default again. He said, well, I don't know anything about that. You'll have to talk to my lawyer. That was the second time that we had put them on notice of the issue. The third time was the first day of trial.
Now, So what?
So what? The plaintiff can't proceed with this case if he's forfeited.
Well, the case law, though, says that these are actually case, Judge Ferguson's decision, the case law in the circuit states that the specific negative affirmant, which has to do with capacity to sue, must be made, quote, in the response of pleading or by motion before pleading. Did you make a specific negative affirmative about capacity either in the response of pleading or by a motion before pleading?
No, we did not.
Doesn't that make what the district court did absolutely proper? It wasn't timely, so...
Or at least not an abuse of discretion?
Well, at the time we filed our answer, we were not an initial defendant. At the time we filed our answer, they had capacity. They were in good standing. They just let their capacity become forfeited as the case went on.
But you knew about it long. I mean, it's one thing to be in a deposition, find out that they've let the capacity lapse, and go into court and say, look, we're bringing it now at the earliest time we can. But you just stood there and told us, oh, well, now we knew about it way back in
1999.
And then didn't raise it before the court until the start of trial. And let me tell you, district judges are very unhappy when you file things on the day of trial, things that you could have filed much earlier. It's sort of,
for how long?
Not welcome.
For how long did you know about the lack of capacity problem before you made this motion?
Well, we just found out the week before trial. The one thing you do.
When you say we, who's we?
Counsel, my law firm.
When was the deposition?
1999.
And when was the trial?
September 2001.
So when we say we, you don't include the people who were at the deposition?
I'm sorry?
Who was at the deposition?
Plaintiff's counsel, plaintiff's president, and defendant's counsel.
Okay, so when you say we didn't know until the week before trial, who are you including?
The defendant. And the defendant's law firm.
Was the defendant not represented in that deposition?
He was represented.
By counsel?
Yes.
That it was he hired?
I don't know.
It wasn't a volunteer counsel. Somebody came off the street and said, I'm just going to go do this deposition for this guy, right?
Yeah. Mr.
So I don't understand. If his lawyer is there at the deposition and gets the information, is your position that means the defendant doesn't know it? And it's not binding on future counsel, you just get a new lawyer, it's a new day.
No, what I'm saying is when Grauer's counsel took the deposition of Bob Colton in 1999, we asked him, according to the records of the state of Maryland, your corporation, the plaintiff, is in default. He said, I don't know anything about that, you'll have to ask my lawyer. He was on notice of the issue the second time at that point. In October of 2000, the corporate charter was forfeited. There's nothing that could have been done to revive it. We got to trial in September of 2001.
Well, I hear you telling me you knew months before the trial that there was a capacity problem. What am I missing?
No, I didn't know until I checked the record right before trial.
But weren't you on notice early on in the deposition that the capacity problem existed?
Yes.
And then you waited until the day of the trial to make the motion?
Yes.
It sounds like a sandbag.
Well, it wasn't a sandbag because it was the third time the issue had been raised with the other
side. Well, whether it's a sandbag or not, how are you going to persuade us that this was an abuse of district court discretion? This is not a jurisdictional issue. It's not one of those things you could raise it an appeal or any kind of legal trial and then it stops proceedings. This is a kind of issue that can be waived by not raising it properly. It seems to me you admitted that this was not raised properly, and now you have to argue in a sort of unpleasant position of having to argue that the district court abused its discretion when you've admitted that you or your predecessor counsel didn't do what he was supposed to. How are you going to do that?
We raised it at trial and on appeal because it was the third time during the course of the case that the issue
I understand, but how are you going to persuade us that that was an abuse of discretion for the district court to say, look, you did not comply with our rules. You could have complied with our rules. You could have filed it long before, and I exercised my discretion not to consider a motion that was not timely raised. Isn't that what district judges do all the time?
Yes.
Do you want to move on to your next issue?
I would like to. The next issue is the copyright registration itself. The case was about these coupon books that had a number of coupons.
This, of course, found there was registration. There was testimony that there was registration.
There was. If you go back and look at the testimony, Mr. Colton testified about three different corporations he was operating. In the next few pages, the question was, did you file a copyright registration for each one of these books? The answer was yes. I asked him on cross-examination, well, you testified about different corporations and different businesses. Let me ask you a question. Did Stefanoni, the Maryland corporation, ever file a copyright registration? His answer was, I have no idea. So you've got conflicting testimony between Mr. Colton.
And the trial judge resolved the conflicting testimony. That's the way it always happens at a trial.
He does, but...
Was there any documentary evidence offered by anybody as to these registrations?
No. Exhibits 1, 2, and 3 to the complaint were the copyright registrations. They were never offered or admitted at trial. So when we... If they had submitted the registrations at trial, we'd cross-examine Mr. Colton. The registrations say that you're asking for copyright protection for original text, compilation, and artwork. But his bare statement that we filed a copyright registration doesn't answer the question, what are you actually seeking to protect? Is it the compilation? Is it the artwork? Or is it the logo that you're provided by the coupon provider?
The territory here slightly. The question was whether there were copyright registrations filed and whether the district court made a... But it's clearly erroneous in so concluding, right?
Right.
And you're saying that it was wrong.
It is.
That all the district court did was credit somebody's testimony or somebody else's.
Yes. But the court has to find what was registered. Is it the book itself? Is it the compilation? Or is it the parts of the book? Now, even if the judge found that there was a copyright registration, that moves us on to the next issue, and that is, are these books themselves, either in component parts or as a compilation, subject to copyright protection? In order to be subject to copyright protection, there has to be at least some minimal level of originality or creativity. And what happens is you have a book with a total value of $1,500, and somebody takes a bunch of contracts off the shelf, puts them in a book form to where they total $1,500. The logos that are in the books, the Dairy Queen logo, the two-for-one language is not subject to copyright. Mr. Colton himself testified his only concern was that he had a contract for each one of those coupons. When I asked him at trial, do you care at all about the organization of the coupons? He said, no, all I really care about is that I have a contract. There is no original thought that went into the compilation of the coupon books themselves. If Mr. Colton had testified, I had an idea, I want to put a dinner coupon book together and put it in some form of order, put the salad, entree, dessert in some form of order.
Was this put to the district court in a way where it had to rule on whether the whatever was registered was copyrightable?
Yes. At the end of the plaintiff's case, we made a motion to dismiss. And we said, Judge, they didn't get the copyright registrations in as evidence, so we don't know what is being copyrighted.
Well,
and each of the elements...
Could you have even put those in the evidence yourself?
I could have, yes.
But you're saying that there wasn't material before the district court judge from which he could make an informed ruling as to whether they were copyrightable.
Yes. I'm saying, number one, he didn't have information in front of him to show that there was a what exactly was copyrighted. He had a statement from Mr. Colton that said, I filed a copyright registration. He had, on cross-examination, a direct question, did the plaintiff step in out the Maryland Corporation, because we're talking about other entities, ever file a copyright registration? He said, I have no idea. The way to resolve that would have been for plaintiff's counsel to submit the copyright registrations themselves.
You know, it sounds to me like a lot of the stuff you're arguing here, the kind of stuff you argued in trial, fact. Inferences to be drawn from testimony, inferences to be drawn from the failure to submit better proof when you submit weaker proof. Sure, registration certificates would have been better, but those are the kind of things that get resolved at trial, and for better or for worse, you have a district judge who looked at all the stuff and ruled against it. You have to persuade us that, depending on the issue, that you just begin to give discussion or there was no evidence to support findings. I mean, that's very hard to do, and I'm yet to get there.
Okay. What I think the best way to look at this is the coupon book itself. If you take, you know, 1, 2, or 20 coupon books and you put them side by side, they're all the same. If you take Stepanout's coupon book itself and you look at each component part, you cannot find a component part that is original to Stepanout and subject to copyright registration. The logo...
But we have held in a number of cases that you don't have to have originality in every particular part. In fact, you can take a number of generic parts and string together the right way, you can have a copyrightable work.
Yes.
And Feist tells us you don't need a lot of creativity you only need a tiny bit of creativity for something to become copyrighted.
But I understand that's what Feist said, and that's what we argued to the district court judge. The question is, we never get up to that fine, minimal level of creativity. And the way we get to that finding is Mr. Colton's testimony itself. Mr. Colton,
why can't the district judge just look at this thing and say, look, it's not a phone book. This is not one of those things where it's all listed alphabetically with sort of all the names in one column and then the numbers in the next column. There's nothing to it. Oh, it's a big list, which is what was about. This is a question of how you lay out the coupons, how big you make them, what size you make them, there are various judgments that have to be made. And coupon books can be made in different ways. They can be made with carrots, they can be made with long, they can be made square, and all those. There's not a lot of creativity involved in making those decisions, but
so just
enough.
So I asked Mr. Colton, what about the compilation, the arrangement? He said, any arrangement in coupon books are standard in the industry, therefore no originality. What about your coupon books, Mr. Colton? Do you care, or did you have any input into the arrangement? His answer was, I couldn't care less. What happened is there was simply a mechanical compilation of books that total up to either $1,500, $2,500, or $3,000, or whatever the amount is.
So in the factual findings, number 71, Stepanout assembled, coordinated, collected, selected, and or arranged the formats, coupon sizes, expiration dates, language, colors, fonts, perforations, number of coupons per page, and type of settings of Stepanout coupon book. That's not supported by the record?
It is not. And it's specifically rejected by Mr. Colton's own testimony.
You're at 5 minutes. Would you like to
now
reserve it?
Thank you.
We'll hear from opposing counsel.
Okay. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Neil Tomlinson from the Cobiega Tomlinson firm in Las Vegas, representing Stepping Out.
You were very lucky to win this case below.
Well, Your Honor, my partner tried it. I didn't have a hand in trying it, so I can't take it.
I didn't mean you personally, but...
Your Honor, I just want to make a couple points. First of all,
your partner needs to be congratulated.
Well, he is one of the Nevada's top fire lawyers, my mentor.
It
wasn't a surprise to me that he won.
There were a lot of close issues that could easily have gone the other way.
Your Honor, I'll tell you exactly why those issues didn't go the other way. That's because Mr. Holtis had one major problem at trial. He had a client who had absolutely no credibility, and that was the difference at trial. This was a bench trial, as you know, and Judge Hunt was in the best position to look at these coupons. He compared every one of them, and he listened to the testimony. He listened to the testimony of Bob Fulton, and he listened to the testimony of Raymond Grauer, and that's how he made a decision. There was a huge problem with Mr. Grauer's credibility, and that's obvious if you read any part of the record whatsoever.
Well, what tantalizes me is counsel's statement that Mr. Colton gave away the copyrightability issue by saying there's no compromises, I didn't do anything, it's all standard, it's just industry junk, and I couldn't care less.
Well,
is that what happened?
That's not what happened, Your Honor.
I'm surprised it didn't.
And actually, while we're on that, let me address that right now. If you look at the record, Volume 2, those certificate of registration were stipulated.
Where are you looking at Volume 2?
Looking at Volume 2, base page number 469.
Read it.
This is the joint pretrial order.
Joint pretrial order.
Stipulated exhibits. 2, the 3 purported registrations of copyright attached as exhibits to plaintiff's second amended complaint. These will be listed as joint exhibits 7 through 9. Now, if you look at Volume 1, the complaint is in Volume 1 of the excerpt of record, and all 3 certificates of registrations are in there. Those did come in there. Those were before the court at the trial.
I'm sorry, what page is that?
On the joint pretrial order or the...
I have the pretrial order, the Volume 1, the complaint.
It would be Volume 1, page 29.
Page 29?
Yes.
Where do you say this in your brief?
Your Honor, I think it's in the brief. I can't point you to the page right now. I can look if you'd like, but this information clearly came into the record. And it was stipulated there.
You were responding to the counsel's argument here, I gather, was what you're doing. He said if only these things were attached, it would have been fine. But in these things that were attached to the complaint, only the exhibits, everything would have been fine. And so you are answering by saying they were part of the pre-trial.
Well, I just want to make sure there's no mistake. These clearly came into evidence, and I sat the last couple of days and read every word of that transcript because, I didn't participate in the trial at all. But I know for a fact that somewhere in that transcript they even talked about those coming into evidence. But they were stipulated before trial, with the joint pre-trial order. So they clearly were into evidence, and as you know, those registration certificates, those are prima facie evidence of ownership. So the ownership issue is really a non-issue here. There was plenty of evidence.
I'm sure you, though, this could have been made clear in your briefs. It came as a surprise to me.
That's why I ask you. I mean, we really pay attention to this. It would have been nice to have it right in there. There's a big fight over the registrations, and I'm sort of baffled as to what the evidence was. And then I assume you clear it up. We'll ask the other side if that's the case, that we were stipulating an evidence in the pre-trial order. Not unusual at all.
Now, you understand, of course, we also read all of these volumes in the appendix page for page, but comments to that. Well, no, that's the thing about the appendix. I mean, we do rely on the briefs.
Yes, the briefs are a roadmap.
As a roadmap to these materials, which we appreciate, but it's not in the briefs, it's very hard to find them.
Understood. I'd like to address just for a minute the independent compilation issue. The fact that these coupon books were compilations and therefore protected.
This was a question Judge Todd asked you when he skillfully diverted attention by pointing to the registration of the figures. And I think the question was, didn't Mr.
Colton
give away the game
quote, second, and give away the game by saying, I didn't give a darn about this. This is about the arrangements.
No, I think that those statements are taken out of context. I think Mr. Colton is a businessman. He's not a lawyer. What he was saying was, I rely on other people to do that. Okay, I rely on people I hire graphic artists, in fact, to make these coupons. He was concerned more of running the business aspect, not the creativity part. However, there's clear testimony in the record on the compilation, and one of those elements, as you know, is selection, coordination, and arrangement. Mr. Grauer, when he came into this whole thing, he had no experience in the coupon book industry at all. And one of the number one things to know in the coupon industry business is where to put these coupons within the book itself. On the staple is where you want to put your best ones, the prime coupons, in the back and in the front. That is organization, that is coordination, and that is part of why these coupon books should be protected, why they are protected, and why Judge Hunt found that they were protected.
I'm sorry, you are now citing what when you give us a lesson in how to do coupon books?
Vice.
I mean, it's very, very useful.
Vice is one case.
No. Vice set the standard, but I thought you were referring to evidence in the record that tells us what you just represented, that arrangement of the coupon book requires skill and creativity. And I was just asking, what are you citing? What is the record? Assuming this is not just a personal lesson you're giving us based on your experience.
No, I'm telling you that by reading the transcript, I don't have a page right in front of me, but
can you tell us testimony? Can you tell us a witness?
Yes, Bob Colton. Bob Colton.
The guy who said, I don't care much about these things.
You know, I gotta say, in context, if you were to read some of the testimony, I would suggest you look at Bob Colton's testimony, and you look at Raymond Grauer's testimony, but especially Raymond Grauer's cross-examination. That's the whole case. And also the deposition of a dreadhead of Whitfield, who was the former graphic artist. Now, one point I do want to make.
When you read the transcript front to back, and you didn't make any notes?
I made a lot of notes.
You don't have them, of course, with you today. No,
unfortunately, I can't cite you to the exact page now.
You can give us an approximate page? You showed Mr. Colton, right? Is it in the back? Is it in the cross?
It's in direct. Mr. Colton's direct testimony.
Okay. Is it new extra?
On this, do I move on, or if you want to stay on that point, Your Honor?
No, go ahead.
As far as the creativity element, there was a graphic arts department within Stepping Out. Why would you ever have two graphic artists working for you if there was no element of creativity like Mr. Grau wants you to believe there was?
To copy other people's work.
No, that was Mr. Grauer's business, not Stepping Out's business.
I mean, I don't know.
I would like to jump back just briefly to the capacity issue. I just want to make two points. The first one is that it appears that Grauer is trying to put the burden of capacity onto Stepping Out. Well, in fact, that's incorrect. You look at the FDIC v. Calhoun case. They have the burden to raise the capacity issue. It's a defense. And they clearly did not raise that in a timely fashion. If you don't timely raise it, you waive it.
Well, that's kind of what an old judge used to say in Seattle. Don't shoot a dead duck twice.
I appreciate that, guys. One last point, a few seconds left, on the jurisdiction issue. I don't think this has been discussed yet, but jurisdiction, the court had specific jurisdiction. We've relied on Columbia Pictures and the Panavision cases. I think that the key
it's is... It's another mighty close one that your partner pulled out.
That's why he's my partner, Your Honor.
Well, I was interested that the district court judge gave absolutely no reason as to why he found personal jurisdiction. He was simply denied the motions.
And I wasn't involved in those motions, Your Honor, so I don't
know.
Well,
your partner was, and you're stuck with that.
I am stuck with it. On that jurisdiction.
I mean, the defendant was never stepped foot in Nevada, right?
He signed a purchase order that was sent to him from Western Mailing. Western Mailing was the distribution company that Stephan Out first used, but then after Grauer stole the coupon disc and started printing his own, they also used Western Mailing. Western Mailing is located in Las Vegas.
He didn't use Western Mailing.
I submit that that's not right, because why then would Mr. Grauer have to sign the authority on that? He signed a document, and I can point you to the exhibits. This is exhibit 22, 22A, and 23 at the trial, and this is specifically in Raymond Grauer's cross-examination.
Are they in the excerpts?
The reference is in the transcript to Raymond Grauer's cross-examination. Clearly, he admitted on cross-examination that he signed off on this Western Mailing and Kavanaugh Press the purchase order that authorized the printing and the mailing of that. And while we're talking about that, I think it's very important.
You used an interesting set of words, signed off on. Is that the same as signed?
He signed it.
His name is signed on there.
It was addressed to him, and he signed it. There was a space for his signature.
You've seen that?
What was the
purpose? I've seen his testimony that he signed it in the excerpts of record that are before you. Raymond Grauer's cross-examination.
We don't have the purchase order with the signature.
I don't believe it's in the excerpts, Your Honor.
Trust, but verify.
What is the point of signing the first order? I'm not quite sure I understand.
Well, I think the
usually what happens is you get a purchase order and you fill it. I'm just not seeing what this signing is.
I think it's important, Your Honor, because it shows that you purposely directed activity within the state of Nevada. It, on top of knowing that Mr. Colton was moving his business to Las Vegas, he also signed a purchase order that clearly was authorizing the distribution and mailing of these coupon books through Las Vegas, Nevada. He purposely injected himself into Nevada. That's why we have jurisdiction here.
I think you misspoke yourself. You said Colton. You didn't
mean it. I'm sorry, Grauer. Thank you. I would like to just address briefly the Corbin case that Grauer relies on here. That's the case with those Swedish doctors who published some articles in the journal, and those journals apparently made their way to California. And so they were trying to get jurisdiction over them in California. Grauer had substantially more activity in Nevada than those Swedish doctors did in California. For one, there wasn't any purposeful availment on the part of the Swedish doctors in that Corbin case. So I think that's distinguishable. Here we had specific acts by Grauer. We had the signing of the document, the knowing and utilizing of Western Mailing, who was also Stephan Out's prior distribution company. So we had purposeful availment there, and I think that's just the point I wanted to make on that.
You know, it's not clear to me. I'm still trying to figure out what this transaction with Western Mailing was and how the signing of the purchase order had an effect. There was not much. I mean, the Western Mailing was a separate company. It's a separate company.
That's correct.
And one could easily do business with them and yet have no contacts with Nevada that they're on jurisdiction in this case. I mean, it's not like they open an office in Nevada and they say, well, you've got personal jurisdiction for all purposes.
Well, I think it's very important, Aaron. I think for two reasons. First, if those coupon books aren't mailed out, where's the harm? Where's the confusion? They never get distributed. So you've got the printing. That's one thing. It happened in another state. But the actual thing that causes the harm are when these coupon books are distributed out. And so that's a key hub and a key piece of this whole puzzle is the distribution, the mailing.
And the mailing occurred in Nevada?
That's right. What happens is the printer ships the coupon books to the distribution facility, which is Western Mailing, and that's located in Las Vegas. So the actual coupon books that are being produced by Gow, they actually go through the state of Nevada. That's why that issue is so important.
Okay, I didn't...
And I lost my second part of that, but
okay.
I think I've made my point. Just two quick points. First on the damages issue, there was one of the issues raised by Crowder was that the award of damages was not justified. In this case, I would say we had unrefuted expert witness testimony by a CPA who had reviewed Stepanow's historical profits and many, many documents relating to the sales that were made to Mueller. And that testimony was unrefuted because, as you know, prior to trial, their expert witness was excluded. And so let me jump to that issue real quick, the exclusion of defendant's expert. This was proper. There was an issue with that expert that came up even before the issue with this list of cases that were required by Rule 26. There was an issue. He was holding himself out as a CPA, and he had no authority to do that. He didn't have the CPA designation. And so that was how that issue first was raised, that he wasn't qualified to even be an expert in this case because this case required the skills of the CPA. So what happened is there was a motion that was filed to exclude this expert. He was a professor of economics, real estate, he was an economics professor and professor of real estate finance at UNLV. He was unqualified, so they brought this motion, and he never did produce the correct list of cases as required. And he had no justification for that, for Rule 37.
He managed to irk the district judge.
I'm sorry?
There's no doubt about it. He managed to irk the district judge.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly the opposite of what your partner did.
That's why I raised the CPA issue, Your Honor, because I think
wasn't what he did close enough?
No, it wasn't.
I mean, he did come up with a list.
He came up with a list, John, that had 20 cases on it. And then later on, he tried to come up with a list that had 120-plus cases on it. He added 100 cases. That's a lot of cases. And that is prejudicial to the plaintiffs. And so that's why that ruling to exclude was correct. It's correct under Elvis versus Colorado Bell.
It's a pretty drastic remedy to exclude the... basically, you're cutting the heart out of the party's case when you exclude the expert. And it just doesn't strike me that this was clearly not an abuse of discretion on the district court's part.
Well, it was not an abuse of discretion. I think clearly there's case law to support it, the rules themselves support it.
Didn't the expert say one? I don't even have access to it.
Well, and that's why it's important, because he says in his deposition that he can't possibly come up with a list, and then once he becomes aware that, catches on that, hey, I might get excluded here, then he tries to come up with a list, and then magically we have a list. So, is that list accurate? It's not. And even if you say, okay, well, it's something
that I can certainly see district court saying, look, you came up with the long list late, and therefore plaintiff's counsel, is going to have to work extra hard to track this down. And you know what? We're going to make you as a defendant pay for that. because it happens so late, they have to hire extra help or maybe defense counsel, or his partner will have to give up a weekend packing it out, and by God, we're going to make you pay for it because of the inconvenience. Why wouldn't that have been the more appropriate remedy rather than saying, you go to trial basically without an expert? It's sort of like saying you go to trial, but you're not really going to be able to prove anything. You're going to have a duo of experts, except that the other guy doesn't get an expert. So, you know, sort of like fighting one guy gets a sword, and the other guy just stands there.
But it
strikes me as a little, I can see where the district court was peak and justifiably unhappy with the expert, but punishing the party like this by cutting the hollow of their case strikes me as excessive.
Well, I think it's important to consider the time, too, John. This was late in the game, and discovery was closed, so it wasn't like we had lots of time to do discovery on this issue. So I think that plays.
Discovery could have been reopened for this purpose. I was just sitting here thinking about what the district court could have done if it had been if the test is, and maybe there's not a test, but I would have thought the test would be you can impose sanctions. But the sanctions have to be geared to the transgression, and they have to be commensurate. And to some extent, they have to be least restrictive in the sense that you don't nuke somebody's case, but you could achieve all the results you want to, that you need to achieve in terms of fairness, by just giving the one side extra money. Say, okay, put a few more associates on this, you got to do it in a hurry. So the other side is going to have to pay for it. You try to track down those things. And I can't imagine that your firm could not have tracked down those 100 cases in a matter of a few days if it had decided to put all the necessary resources into it. How hard can it be?
Well, I think it certainly could have been done, but
if it could have been done, why shouldn't it have been done, especially if we were to say this would call that just the cost? I mean, we realize that doing things is going to hurt. I mean, let's say the guy who provided the list to begin with. You would have no choice but to do it at your client's expense. Let's say you come up with 120 cases to begin with and give you all the information. You would have to do it. Your client would have to pay for it. So let's say now you got it late. We understand that it's more expensive to do things in a hurry. And by God, we'll stick it to the other side. I can understand that. But kill the expert.
That's
hard to justify.
Your Honor,
my time's up. No, I'll give
you a minute. Always get up when you're getting your feet.
The red light
goes on. With all due respect, Your Honor, if you're going to allow that, you may as well take the federal rules and throw them out the window, because why do we have Rule 26 and why do we have Rule 27 if we're not ever going to use them?
Well, let me ask counsel.
That's your answer?
That's my answer.
Well, that you need an extra time? Okay, I'm sorry, just go ahead.
Is this not the expert that you said was not qualified because he wasn't in the county?
That's absolutely right.
Okay, maybe we're just talking at the wind.
But if there's another justification, if you want to rely on another justification, that's fine to talk about that. But I've heard you try to justify the saying this on a basis of sanctions, essentially sanctions for coming up with a list late. And that just strikes me, if you want to walk away from that one and pick up, the other action, well, that's fine. I don't know, it's your choice.
Well, see, I did that first, you know.
Yeah, I thought I addressed that, I wasn't trying to address anything. It certainly could have been done, well, anything can be done. I mean, if something has to be done, it can be done. So, I can't stand here and tell you, could we have investigated these extra...
Just hold on a minute. District court gave mixed reasons for making its decision. Now, one of the reasons is inadequate. What does that do to the district court's decision? I mean, if you're not on board to say, well, district court had this reason which is self-sufficient, and another reason which is self-sufficient, we don't have to rely on the one because we're not relying on them. But I have the impression that the district court was moved to strike the expert as much by the failure to provide the list as by the, as, that was
a necessary grounds for the decision.
Well, I don't dispute that, Your Honor.
Well, if it was necessary, and it's not a ground that you're willing to defend here, or able to defend here, then it seems to me that you may have an abuse of discretion.
No, I think clearly there is no abuse of discretion here. A reversal on the issue is not warranted. The key thing is it's prejudicial to the plaintiff. When you're preparing for trial, and then all of a sudden you've got an expert who had 20 cases, and then the next day he's got 120 cases, you know, what do you have to do? Do you have to hire another 20 lawyers to help you get ready for trial?
At least.
You've got 5 minutes on the money. 18 seconds, I believe, something like 10 seconds.
Here we go. Just to revisit the originality issue for a second,
Let me ask you a question. Are you Brian
Olfus? I am.
Is your bar number 002720?
Yes.
Are you the person who signed this joint pretrial order, 77 pages approved by the trial court?
Yes.
And in there, does it say the parties stipulate that the following exhibits may be entered into evidence at trial, reading page 27 of 77, number 2, the 3 purported registrations of copyright attached as exhibits to plaintiff's second amended complaint. These will be listed as joint exhibits 7/9.
When counsel mentioned that, I thought back to that point, and I don't remember whether they were in there or not. If they're in there, then I'll certainly withdraw.
Well, in your brief, Stepanout never put the purported copyright registrations themselves into evidence. Is that wrong?
That is wrong.
That is wrong. Stepanout never put the actual purported copyright registrations themselves into evidence, page 9. Is that wrong, too?
That is wrong because they're in
the stipulation. How do you explain this, counsel? You've misrepresented the record to us.
Your Honor, when we did the trial, because they were not an exhibit at trial, they were not submitted.
They were in part of the joint pretrial order. They were joint exhibits by your stipulation.
Yes.
And you made a large measure of your brief out of this argument that these were never admitted in evidence and there was no evidence to support all these findings. That's dead wrong.
I am wrong.
Yes. What's your answer? Why did you do that?
Because I didn't go back and read the pretrial order.
Is everything else in your brief wrong too?
No.
How do we know that?
Because everything else is cited in the record. I went back through the trial record and did not look at the joint pretrial order.
Is the pretrial order provide for automatic admission of the things in there, or simply say the admissible is moved? In other words, case you have any objections in case a party chooses to move it or not.
Your Honor, I don't remember the exact term.
You don't understand pretrial orders?
I do.
What do they do?
Well, they set the stage and set the exhibits for trial.
Exactly right. And the judge signed off on that. This is the evidentiary basis for this bench trial.
But it could do one of two things. One of them, it could say these things come in, or it could simply say these things need to be admissible if moved.
My record.
It's wrong or it's not. What is it?
It is wrong, Your Honor.
Wrong.
It is wrong. I would like to spend a moment on the damages issue. And that is when Stepanout CPA expert got on the stand to testify about the damages that were caused by the copyright infringement. He had a list of all of the coupon books that Stepanout and National Savings Corporation have submitted, and all the profits from those coupon books. When I asked him on cross-examination, there are 3 coupon books at issue here. There are other coupon books listed in your compilation. There's an $1,800 book, there's a grocery book, there are other books up there. Did you go back and determine whether the coupon books at issue are in your computation of damages? And he said, no. What he had computed was, in essence, a loss of Mr. Mueller's business over a period of years. He did not compute the damages from the copyright issue. That would mean that the court would have to find that the defendant, Mr. Brower, had a contractual interference claim and took all the business away from Mr. Mueller. The fact is, when Stepanout moved to Nevada, Brower had no employment contract, he had no non-compete contract, he had no non-disclosure. He went out and got a customer that used to be Stepanout's customer, and he used and sold them products that were not subject to copyright. The issue at trial was whether these items were subject to copyright protection. The court found they were, the court found that there were damages as a result. Well, it is not property of Mr. Coleman. It is a generic coupon book that has coupons from different coupon providers. The real potential problem for my client was if the court found that there was interference with the coupon providers themselves, the Dairy Queens and the Burger Kings that had contracts with the plaintiff.
Well, is Mr. Coleman or his company going to have a negotiated to get the coupons, negotiated the price,
Yes, but when I asked Mr. Colton on cross-examination, did you have any problems with coupon providers? And his answer was, we had very little. There were few problems. There were some angry letters, but no damages, and certainly nothing that could be
imputed to
coupons were
bogus.
I'm sorry?
Your client's coupons were bogus.
No, they weren't bogus, Your Honor. His testimony was that when he worked for Stepanout had contracts with coupon providers. When he went and did the second set of coupon books for National Savings Corporation, his testimony was that National Savings Corporation had contracts. There is deposition testimony there from National Savings Corporation that it was their responsibility to go get the contracts, and if they didn't have contracts, those contracts shouldn't be included in the book. Now, the plaintiff has settled his claims with National Savings Corporation. It wasn't Mr. Grauer's job to go out and get the coupons. And in fact, there haven't been any damages claims from those coupon providers themselves. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is argued. Stand submitted.